Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're talking about a subject we return to time and time again on the Tortoise Shack, and that is the role and the experiences of whistleblowers in Ireland. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and a man who himself is a whistleblower, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you keeping?
Not too bad, Tony. Looks like it's going to be a great conversation. Great guests lined up here.
Yeah, no, we really do. But before we go there, Martin, I am conscious that you sent in your letter in the Irish Times, and you refer to your own health and your own situation as a vulnerable person in terms of the acceptable deaths level. I do want to get it on the record that, you know, you are out of hospital, you are on the mend, but you are extremely vulnerable to
there is an awful lot of people in this country who are vulnerable. My parents are both very vulnerable. I have a nephew who already had Kawasaki disease some years back, and a fine young lad and fit and capable, but also vulnerable. Vulnerability is not just old people. It's a lot of people in this society. And if you're going to have a conversation about letting vulnerable people die off, well, then talk to them first, because as we say always, Tony, nothing about us without us.
I think that speaks for itself. So no, thanks. And I'm glad you wrote the letter in, and I hope they do find it themselves to publish it. Anyway, enough of that. We have two fabulous guests, and listeners of the Tortoise Shack would be very familiar with Louise Bayliss in her work with Spark. She's one of the co-founders of Spark. She's also a campaign coordinator with Focus Ireland. Brilliant advocate on homelessness, and particularly in relation to single parents and these situations that we find ourselves in. But that's also not something what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about her role as a whistleblower. And we're also joined by Dr. Tom Clonan, who again is a whistleblower and very well known for his work in the Irish military. He's also been a Shannon candidate. Tom, are you running again in the upcoming election?
I am, yeah. Third time, last time, give it a go. So because of the vacancy created by Ivana Bacik's election in Dublin South, I'll run again. But I mean, as was the case on the previous two occasions, I don't expect to be elected, but it's a way of raising the issues around disability and trying to advocate for a human rights approach to any kind of difference in Ireland, whether it be so-called physical or intellectual disabilities. It's just to try and amplify that platform. And I found it very helpful in that regard. But as for being elected, if I was a betting man or woman, I wouldn't put a tenner on me anyway.
Yeah, it's a good
some great candidates.
Good practice run for the presidency, Tom. If that.
No, Martin, stop. But in fairness,
Martin, I've had experience of character assassination, and actually, you know, that's the one election contest where people get absolutely pulled asunder. Mm. And I admire anybody who would put their hat into that particular ring, but certainly I wouldn't have the constitution for that. It's, excuse the pun.
Well, it is.
It's too rough.
I didn't tell you I was going to bring it up, but I do think, you know, people at Trinity are going to get a vote on Ivana Bacik's seat, and Tom, you're putting your name forward, and I commend you for that. And you've always spoken up about disability rights, so we commend you for that as well. And you know, it's not something that you do lightly. So best of luck to you, and whatever about down talking, best of luck to you, Louise. Do you mind if I come to you first? I'd imagine a lot of our listeners might be familiar with your story. They may have watched the brilliant documentary, Mishnock on TG Car, that Tom, you were on the week previous. But do you mind, just if they're not familiar with it, first of all, go check it out. You can hit pause here and go watch it. It's still up on the TG Car player. But please just tell us the story about your experiences in 2011.
Yeah, it was December 2011, and I was working as a psychiatric patient advocate, which meant going in and visiting psychiatric patients in wards. And I was on a 6-month contract. It was in a contract, employee contract. However, when the story got into the media, they changed it to a trainee contract, which forced me to sign a new contract. But when I went into Grange Gorman on the Thursday, which I think was about the 8th or 9th of December, I witnessed that women were being moved from a psychiatric open locked unit for 6 or 7 weeks over Christmas, and they were all being broken up. Now, what was particularly poignant about it was, and I felt guilty at this stage because I was the mother of two young children, They had all their Christmas decorations up. They had the crib in the shared dormitory. They had the Christmas cake being made. And, you know, I was getting advice how to make a Christmas cake because I've never done one. And I still haven't. So I don't know why I asked them. But in theory, I was planning to. And when I left feeling really kind of my spirits uplifted and the Christmas feeling. And then when I was pulled aside by a nurse telling me that the women were all being moved that weekend and dispersed because of staff shortages, my heart was broken because I thought they lived together for 20, 30 years. They were a family, you know, as if their family meant nothing to them. Family isn't just the husband, father and children. It's who we live with on a daily basis, who we choose to be in our lives. And these women were more vulnerable than most of us, and yet were being moved at a most sensitive time in their life. And then the most horrifying part was some of them were being moved into a locked psychiatric unit, which I felt sorry for everybody being moved because I thought it was wrong to break them up. But the idea that people were being put into a locked unit, not on medical reasons or any other, I mean, their liberty was being deprived. Now, I mean, the point has been made that they weren't under the same rules as a locked unit, but you were in a locked unit and those conditions would have prevailed. And then I felt sorry for the women in the locked unit themselves. They were very seriously ill women, and it was very tense in there. The dormitory would be locked during the day. They would be left in the same room all day, every day. You couldn't even sit on somebody's seat because it was so regimented. They had their patterns. And then the idea that five more women were going to be put into this mix was going to be distressing for the ill women and the women who weren't as ill. So in so many levels, it was just horrifying. And I just couldn't believe that as an advocate, we were asked not to say anything about it. It just was horrifying to me that we would just accept that. And I was told, oh, no, we won't accept it. We'll send a report at the end of the year, but that it was going to be allowed to go ahead. And I just thought it was morally wrong. And then the issue was that it was morally wrong and it was legally wrong. And on the 20th of December, like a week later, when the mental health inspector went out to examine what I said, they came back and said everything I said was true. It was a breach of best practice regulations. It shouldn't have happened and shouldn't go ahead. And yet a month later, I was fired because allegedly I didn't know what I was doing. And in fact, I was the only one who was doing the right thing by those patients.
Going to pause the podcast for a moment. It's the beginning of the month. This is when you get to avail of a sample kit, I'd imagine, because you get to pay your £5 and you get a full month, and then you see if you don't like it, you just stop it at the end of the month. It's your trial period, I'd call it, you know.
Jeez, we're not going to make money that way. Sign up for 12 months, Tony. 12 months. Do the 12 months option.
I get that, but I mean, if you just want to see what's actually there behind the paywall, there's a lot going on. Last week, you've missed out on podcasts with Cathy Davey and Siobhan Luff. You've missed out on podcasts with the Muslim Sisters of ERA. You know, we do get these out, but they go behind the paywall, they go to patrons, and you get a consolidated RSS feed. So one-stop shop, all the podcasts that are on the network come out into your feed whenever we basically publish them, a few minutes after I can put them together. And that's £5.50 a month. So I would say to you, it's the start of the month. Try it now. I know that sounds now we're giving you the sales pitch. Now I want to tell you that we actually would love you to join us because we really do need the help.
Yeah, we do. We absolutely do. We put these podcasts out so that everybody can listen to them. And the aim is that those who have the few bob can give us the few bob to keep it going for everybody. So just remember that place you have to go to. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And just come on in, sign up for a month. Look, if you don't like it after a month, nobody's keeping you here.
Let you get back to the podcast. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks. That's kind of the universal, unfortunately, it's referred to as tall poppy syndrome. It's referred to all of these things that we talk about and the experiences across the board. I'd love to come, we will dig into it in a bit more detail, but I want to come to Tom because, Tom, you had a similar experience insofar as in the reaction, but yours was kind of in 1996, like you were given permission in the army to write what was called Women in Combat, the status and roles assigned to female personnel in the Permanent Defence Forces. And it wasn't received very well, Tom. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I suppose like Louise, you know, I was a serving officer in the Defence Forces. I was a highly valued, respected officer. I started my doctoral research with the permission of both the university and the Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces. And during the period of my research journey, I uncovered the most appalling instances of discrimination, bullying, sexual harassment, sexual assault and rape of female soldiers. During that period, I was promoted to the rank of captain, and I was also assigned as a staff officer for the Chief of Staff in Defence Forces headquarters, in the actual beating heart of the organisation. So like Louise, I was a person who was given responsibility within the setting where the wrongdoing took place. I was, I would like to think, popular amongst my peers. I mean, I'd had command of troops overseas in a very well-known, very violent deployment to Lebanon in 95 and 96, had command of troops in that very, very difficult situation. So I was respected, valued, but the minute I brought forward negative findings about wrongdoing, and in my case, in the case of the Defence Forces, systemic and systematic harassment and sexual assault of female personnel, that was the day that my, I suppose, status was reversed. So I went from being a hero to zero in one conversation, in one afternoon in Defence Forces headquarters in December of 2000. And that was the end of my relationship with what was my extended family, my military family, in which I was completely invested. And that we didn't have the term whistleblower at the time, really. It was only in the mid-noughties when I met John Devitt from Transparency International. And he told me over a cup of coffee, he said, what happened to you was whistleblower reprisal. And I'd never heard this expression before, but it was really therapeutic for me to have the language to describe what had happened to me, because I was completely reeling. So like Louise, I was then the target of a campaign of, ironically, bullying, harassment, character assassination. And basically what the army tried to do was, by engaging in reprisal, was to try and invalidate me as an officer, as a researcher, as a citizen, as a parent, as an Irish person, and just in, rather than deal with the substance of the research, they decided to try and destroy me in every respect. I was threatened with criminal prosecution for an alleged breach of the Official Secrets Act, which I was told a file was being sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions and that I would face charge, trial, and possibly imprisonment. I thought I was going to lose my job as a lecturer in the Institute of Technology because my very qualifications were being brought into question. And here we are 21 years later, and it appears, following on from the Women of Honour, from that excellent documentary by Katie Hannon and RTE, that systemic and systematic abuse of women and some male soldiers, and this was confirmed by both Minister Coveney and by the Secretary General of the Department of Defence, who used those words, current systemic and systematic abuse continues to this day. And like Louise, in all of the last 21 years, the only person that has ever been named or mentioned in a negative way in relation to any of this, not the perpetrators, not the architects of the policies and procedures that created this situation, but me. I'm the only person who's ever been singled out for reprisal or for negative reinforcement. And that's been similar to Louise's experience in that she became, you know, she lost her job. She was treated appallingly.
And totally financially vulnerable. Louise, two young children, you know, you're trying to keep a roof over your heads. You're trying to go through a lot. I mean, again, I've spoken to you several times on different podcasts, Louise, and, you know, people don't get the work that you put in the background for other organizations and the volunteerism that and the spirit of trying to give back that you have. But you really were born in fire, like forged in steel at this stage, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, when I talk about poverty and I talk about things, I'm talking very much from a lived experience in that time. And one of the only regrets I have at the time is when, after the public outcry, the organization came back to me to offer my job back, but made me sign a different contract, made me sign a trainee advocate contract. And then I never worked a day again. And my only regret is that I didn't have the financial wherewithal behind me to reject them. Because I wasn't complying with, but because of financial pressures, I signed that contract because I needed the money. And in effect, I basically gave them their expensive PR exercise. They paid me for 6 months, did nothing with me, and let me go then.
Yeah.
And I was complicit in that because of financial pressure. And that's my only regret.
We see that pattern with a lot of whistleblowers, and I do talk to a lot of whistleblowers. And we spoke to Alice Mary Higgins recently, Senator Alice Mary Higgins, and she said that what they're doing now, you know, the way they're looking at the whistleblower legislation and they're looking at all of that. And she said they see patterns. And there were 12 of us, and we've come to a different conclusion. We see a playbook. We don't see patterns. We see a playbook. We see a very specific playbook where they attack you where you live, and that's in the pocket. And that's what they first go for, is to put you under financial pressure. We see it every single time, whether it's losing your position, whether it's coming after your reputation so that nobody else will hire you. This is a pattern of behavior against whistleblowers, particularly in Ireland. Have you found that, Tom?
Yeah, consistently. And sadly, I would say in the context of the recent Mishnock documentary, there were concerted attempts made to try again, to, in my case, to try and stop the broadcast, and also to suggest, amongst other things, again, you know, that I had behaved questionably or unethically, or that I'd done something wrong 21 years ago. And again, you use the word playbook, and that was precisely the same playbook that was in vogue by the military authorities back in 2000. And unfortunately, and this is one of the things that I feel very passionately about, the perpetrators of the reprisal against me back in 2001 and 2002, many of those individuals have been promoted to very, very senior rank within the Defence Forces today. And we are somehow expected to believe that they will oversee any real or meaningful change of the culture when they have been effectively rewarded for wrongdoing. And you know, I mean, I wouldn't compare my experience to that of Louise. I was very, very lucky in that I was very lucky in that I managed to keep my job, and I managed to, in some ways, kind of try to claw back something of my reputation, but never fully. I mean, I've never been promoted as an academic. I've applied for all sorts of jobs within the university and third level sector. I've never been promoted. I've never been successful. And I, you know, my research was a landmark piece of research that helped to, you know, bring into the public domain, you know, a very, very serious set of issues. You know, the darkest, you know, phenomena that we as a species encounter, which is, you know, sexual assault and rape. I've had lots and lots of publication academically over the years. I've done all of the things that you're supposed to do, but I've never been promoted. So What worries me about whistleblowing per se and the playbook that you describe is that people who engage in wrongdoing are very often rewarded and promoted to very, very senior positions. Whereas people who speak truth to power are very often punished. So that puts me in a difficult position because my children are 20, going on 21, 19, 17 and 14. What do I tell them as a parent about how you should behave in Irish society and in Irish culture? Should you put your hand up and tell the truth about wrongdoing? Or should you pause, think about your own welfare, maybe seek legal advice? That's something about our society that really needs to change.
And there's another aspect. There's another aspect to it too. And you're dead right. People do get promoted for what, shall we say, throwing up the wall. They get promoted for doing it. But another aspect of it is the institutional aspect, in that it can take years when you're blowing the whistle. As you've said, Tom, 20 odd years, Louise hasn't stopped, and you haven't stopped since you started blowing the whistle, Louise. But the institution itself, and the people are replaced as they get promoted, other people are brought in, and those people will also perpetrate the throwing up the wall, the playbook. It's that the institution protects itself. Do you find that, Louise and Tom? I'll go to Louise first.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's funny that you use the word playbook, because it's something I've been talking about recently with my friends and felt they follow the same playbook. And like Tom, before my program was broadcast, there were attempts made to get it pulled off air. There was a solicitor's letter sent basically saying they would be watching everything with a fine-tooth comb and, you know, implicit thing. And I just thought it was really disheartening because very much like Tom said, people did wrong back then, and that's fine. But they're still in their positions. And I went through 4 years of looking for a job with a tarnished reputation and all of that. And they kept their solid jobs and they're fine. And looking back now, it's almost 10 years. And why they couldn't, after 10 years, just let it go, let the program go, put their hands up and say, do you know what, keep our heads down. Or why they couldn't even issue, which I would have so admired, and it would have given me faith in humanity, they'd issued a statement just saying, mistakes were made, lessons were learned, and we hope everybody goes on well. That would have meant the world to me. It would have given me some faith in humanity. But again, unlike Tom, which is where I am fortunate, I did go through really 4 tough years of not even being able to get an interview when I was way overqualified for the jobs I was applying for. I've been very lucky that Focus Ireland did employ me and have promoted me in a couple of times. And really, the qualities that made me...
I want to interrupt and say, not lucky, that's the work and the quality that you put into it, but nonetheless, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, but I was going to say, the qualities that had stopped other organisations hiring me are the very qualities that Focus Ireland respected about me. And that's lovely, because I actually feel I'm with my village. I'm where I should be. And they have no problem with me speaking out, calling out injustice and saying what needs to be said. Even if we are dependent on government funding, they respect that I will say what needs to be said in a respectful way, but I'm not afraid to criticise the government, as I think anybody who's listened to me over the last few years will know. But you know, holding truth to power is important. And I know, Tom, you're saying about what do you say to your children, and I've had that issue too. But I know, just as I know for me, we'll tell our children to do the right thing, even though we know there's an impact, because we go to bed at night time and we sleep tightly and we know we haven't done wrong.
Tom, what about the institutional aspect for you? Do you see that it's an institutional aspect?
Yeah, I mean, there's a strong component to it. Look, in the last couple of weeks, I have become very aware of a very, very high level of anger and resentment towards me from, you know, still today, after 21 years. And anger and resentment towards the women of honour who have made their disclosures, come out in the public record and made very, very difficult and painful disclosures. I'm aware that within the Defence Forces, there's a huge amount of anger and resentment. And I actually find that quite frightening, to think that, you know, when you're talking about something like sexual violence and rape, that there is still a cohort of people, or there's a culture there that would seek to, you know, blame victims, find them. Like in an interview given to Conor Gallagher in the Irish Times on the 8th of October, I'd recommend anybody to read it, Friday the 8th of October. You know, he quotes senior officers as saying that this is a bad time for the organization to receive these disclosures, because we're going through a reorganization and we're looking for more investment. So, you know, it's extremely irritating. They talked about their resentment at having a Me Too moment 23 years before anybody else. I mean, that those are the kind of responses of people who have completely and utterly lost contact with reality and with, you know, the society that they purport to serve. So I think organizations and institutions, depending on the culture, will respond differently. I mean, one, and I take great heart from what Louise said about, of course, you know, when our kids do come to us and say, you know, look for advice, of course we tell them to do the right thing. But I am encouraged to a certain extent by the fact that certainly, Martin, you know this, and we all know this, Louise, that in over the last two decades, nearly almost all Irish whistleblowers who came forward experienced immediate reprisal and attempts to destroy them on so many different levels. But John Devitt of Transparency International tells me that that situation is actually improving slightly.
I want to commend that, because I know even as recently as the last few months when Martin, you appeared at two committees in the Oireachtas, one of them decided to actually pretend that your evidence never happened.
Yeah,
they issued their report.
I'm still smarting over it, Tony.
You were described by journalists who covered the event as the key witness to the committee of the day, and then when the report issued, it was like you never appeared.
That's right.
So when you think about that in terms of the institutional power, and again, I can only speak from my own financial services background and know that people who were involved in some of the situations that went on through the global financial crisis in one of the biggest banks in the world, I think they were fourth and then up to second at one stage, many of them were promoted out of some of the things and into other areas. So, you know, we have to be serious about this, that other people who called out things, there was no justice for. And I'm reminded of several whistleblowers that we know of in terms of what happened with the Irish Central Bank and that. But nonetheless, if I could ask Louise, when you're in that situation, and it's, I mean, again, both documentaries are available on the TG Carr player. I'd recommend listening to or watching both of them. Really well worth it. But when you're in that situation, Louise, and you're looking at women who are extremely vulnerable, I mean, extremely vulnerable. And this was put down to essentially a staffing issue, really, wasn't it? It was a resources issue. This is what we're going to do. Rather than resource the situation, we're going to put them into this horrendous... God, I'm going to use the word horrendous. That's not for you to use. But from where they've gone to where they're going to, just because we wouldn't resource it. And then to hear this as recently as a few weeks ago, no one has turned around saying, well, actually, you know, we've learned lessons out of that. We've changed things as it is. Is it not still disheartening to this day?
It's very disheartening because I thought it was something morally wrong. But when I found the report that said, actually, it wasn't just morally wrong. It was against the procedures. It was against regulations. It was against all of that. So it wasn't just morally wrong. So it wasn't like something that I discovered and, oh, guess what, this is, and we reflect. They knew it was wrong when it was happening, and yet it made no difference. And that's what's scary, that these type of things can go on without this self-reflection. And very much like what Tom said there, that you think 20 years on, 10 years on, 25 years on, that there's space there that people can look back and go, you know, the emotion's gone out of it. We can look back and say, do you know what? We did make mistakes. Hands up. We're sorry. But what is really disheartening, and it's coming from this conversation, is the idea that things won't change when people who agree to the system benefit from the system. So, you know, if I had kept my mouth quiet, I could be sitting here in a managerial role in that organization. If Tom had kept quiet, he could be sitting here as a colonel, or God knows, I don't know the titles of soldiers, but, you know, he could have been promoted away and his life easier. And instead, the people who want actual change to benefit people are kept down at the bottom. And instead of as they usually say, cream rises to the top. In this case, cream literally fell to the bottom. And those that had benefited from the status quo and this abuse of people kept their mouths quiet and were promoted. And that's really disheartening.
Institutional omerta.
Yeah, and I think it's important to highlight in this that it's not just enough to go at the whistleblower for the job. Whistleblowers are bad into the ground. It's like you were taught a lesson. They do not want anybody else being a whistleblower. Therefore, if you lift your head above the parapet, you will be bet into the ground. There is no question about it for any whistleblower that that is what happens. There is nobody on your side, nobody at all. And if anybody for a moment dares to be on your side, they're sidelined, they're moved out of the way, and another willing conspirator is put in place. That is my experience of it, and it's my experience from talking to other whistleblowers as well, that the aim of going at you is not just personal, it's to prevent any other whistleblowers doing what you have done. Do you think that's, you've been the only whistleblower, Tom, to come forward out of all of the defense forces, the only one that's come forward and said this. I mean, that's a testament to how well they keep whistleblowers down.
Yeah, I mean, there's Professor Kate Kenny in NUI Galway has written a great textbook about whistleblowers, and I read it, and I couldn't put it down because it just spoke directly to me, and I'm amazed at Kate's capacity to just get into the actual dynamics of whistleblowing. And, you know, in it she sets out what the organization or institution seeks to do is to destroy the person as a citizen, you know, to destroy your existential identity. So in my case, what they did was they attempted to destroy my reputation as a researcher, as an army officer, as a citizen, and to strip, you know, to make your identity existentially impossible. And then it's an excruciatingly painful experience for somebody like me, and I know it is for Louise. And people say things like, oh, you must have been very brave, or you must be made of like wrought iron to withstand that. But we're not, we're just ordinary people. And it is like really, really painful. And so that's the weapon or the tool that's used. And yes, it has been very effective because, you know, particularly in the case of the Defence Forces, that toxic culture of misogyny and targeting women for sexual assault and so on. I mean, even after 21 years, it's still in place. And that makes me very, very sad because the Minister for Defence at the time, Michael Smith, rang me last week. He's in great health. I think he's in his late 70s, if not his 80s. And he said to me that he was one of the first ministers back in the day to introduce reductions in blood alcohol limits. And he said he got a bit of whip backlash on that, and he had trouble being served in some of his local pubs down in Roscrea, and some of his family members, his kids, got a bit of flack over it. But he said over the years, he saw the road traffic fatalities fall, and he said it gave him great comfort that he'd done something good. But what he said to me last week, it really resonated with me, was that 21 years ago, we put up our hands and said, there is a problem with sexual assault and rape. And he initiated the independent government review, which confirmed that. And it now appears that despite that knowledge 21 years ago, since then, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of young lives have been limited, altered horrifically by sexual assault and rape in what should have been a foreseeable, preventable about how they have managed and behaved over the last 20 years. And, you know, am I confident that that will happen? I don't know. I don't know, but, you know, I think I do take encouragement from the phenomenon that is the Women of Honour, because whilst they might try to shut somebody like me up, they will never silence these women and their incredible bravery and courage to come forward on the record and be identified and be re-traumatised. They'll never, ever put that genie back in the box. Those women are the change that's going to transform the Defence Forces finally. Because if it's not a safe place for women, then it can't purport to defend and protect this society. And, you know, Óglaigh na hÉireann, our Defence Forces, does not belong to a coterie of very vocal and misogynistic senior officers. It belongs to the Irish people, and we want it back.
I think that's a really, really, really powerful point you've made, Tom. And I just pick up on one word, and it's I put it to both of you. You said re-traumatizing. Louise and Tom, if you don't mind, before we bring this to some sort of conclusion, it must be awful having to keep telling your story, Louise, after a decade, and Tom after two decades, to, you know, having to keep telling your story And I put it to you, Martin, as well, in many ways as well. I don't want to leave you out of this, but Louise, you know, it must be that level where that word that Tom used, re-traumatizing.
I can be honest. When I did the documentary, and I was very hesitant about doing it, to be honest, because I was very conscious of, do I want to go back to that time? And I thought I was emotionally prepared. And I will never, ever forget that first day of filming. And I went straight back into the moment, because when something's that powerful, it was so quick for me to reconnect. And while things are really good in my life, I'm happy and everything, I was shocked at how overwhelmed the feelings were when I started talking to Maeve, who did an excellent job producing the programme. To the extent that the first day I drove back from, we filmed in Grange Gorman, and I suppose there was all of that emotional connection as well. And I drove back home and I parked the car, and I actually physically could not get out of the car. I mean, I couldn't get out of the car. And my daughter saw me, and she came along with her friends. They were playing. And she said, "Mom, what are you doing?" And I said, "I just can't move, Sophia. I'll go into the house in a minute." And when I did go into the house, I went straight into my bedroom, called a takeaway for her, and stayed in bed for the day. I couldn't move. I was just overwhelmed. And it surprised me how raw my emotions were and how re-traumatizing it is. And how unhappy I am that 10 years later, the things are still, we're still not where we should be with how we treat people and respect people and ensure, as Tom said, I mean, the most vulnerable, there's so many, and even to back to your point, Martin, today about what's going on with COVID and people and underlying conditions. I mean, where's this idea that we don't protect the most vulnerable, instead of we throw them to the wolves for the vast majority? That's quite depressing and re-traumatizing. But I won't go on about it, because honestly, I could talk about it. But it is so upsetting that we haven't really moved on.
Yeah. Tom, sort of the same point, if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, like these, it's kind of, I hope this doesn't sound wrong, but I actually take great encouragement from what you just described there, because I felt the same way. And I thought, you know, I thought there's something wrong with me. Like, so Maeve and everybody in Midas, Maeve Johnson and Annie Keevan, like, they were very, very good, but they were like emotionally intelligent and psychologically literate. They knew it was going to be difficult, and I didn't really anticipate that. And there was one particular scene where we filmed in, like, you going to Grange Gorman, I went back to McGee Barracks in Kildare, where I was based for 8 years, and we sat in the ruined building, and yeah, that had a really profound effect. And I found in after the broadcast of Mission Up, because of the attempts to have the broadcast stopped, that was very traumatizing. And I spoke to you earlier about how frightening I find the animus and the anger towards me, even after 21 years. I find that quite frightening, and I find it very worrisome, because, you know, you wonder what these people are capable of. But it also reminds me, though, the women and some men that have experienced sexual assault and rape, how many more times traumatizing is that? Like, I can't even begin to conceive of how they have suffered and are suffering. And it really speaks to the fact that the perpetrators, and particularly those who collaborate with the silence around it, really ought to be held to account. And rather than naming and shaming people like myself and Louise, they're the people who really should have a look at themselves in the mirror. And I would say to all of the people in the Defence Forces community who are angry with me, have a look at yourself in the mirror. Because if you're angry with me, you're a part of the problem and not a part of the solution.
Absolutely, Tom. Absolutely. 100% agree with you. I'm going on 22 years dealing with what I've been dealing with and trying to blow the whistle. And I'm very much of the view now, they think that I'm locked in with them. No, no, they're locked in with me. It's me you need to be afraid of. Me. And I'm very much of that opinion, and I don't stop, and I won't stop, and I'm relentless about it. But that's what you have to be a whistleblower.
Can I ask, and maybe I don't know if everybody wants to, just this last question, and I'm conscious that we've gone over time, but I really appreciate this. And I think there's been some really powerful points made, and I hope listeners go off and watch the documentaries and actually understand this, because they're brilliant watches. But at the same time, if there were solutions, or what can be done to improve the situation, maybe you go to Tom first and then Louise after, if that's okay.
Well, I think for Ireland, I really believe that diversity in our institutions and organizations, and, you know, that is, I think, a major key to, you know, moving all of our cultures forward. I think diversity and inclusion is the key to our future, to our relevance, to our survival. And that organizations that are defensive and, you know, either, you know, overly male dominated, or, you know, just aren't inclusive or diverse, are you know, that's the past. And the future, I think, is through diversity and inclusion. And, you know, the human rights based approach to equality that, you know, which has been so successful in Ireland with things like women's reproductive rights, marriage equality, and so on. So we do have that wellspring in Ireland. Irish people are great. They do recognize the importance of these things, but that's the way forward, I think.
Yeah, very good point, Louise.
It's hard to expand on what Tom has said, because he's right. It is the people in power, the white, stale, male men, you know, and until we get that changed, we're going to have these replications. And that's not to say that if we put women in control of boardrooms that it would all be perfect again. It absolutely wouldn't. It's the right type of person we need. But through diversity and inclusion, we will hear those voices coming up. And all joking aside, and, you know, the Tortoise Shack is part of that, by creating diversity of having voices that normally aren't in mainstream media. That's an important vehicle, and you know, all work like that. I think we will eventually, you know, chip away and hopefully pull apart that dominance of a certain group in society. And when we get, I think the vast majority of Irish people and people living in this country are decent, honest people. And if we can get our voices collectively together, we'll do okay.
Tom Clonan, Louise Bayliss, thank you very much for coming on and having a discussion with us this morning. It's always great to talk to people like yourselves. You are exceptional people. And remember that, you are exceptional people. And thank you for having this conversation with us.
And thank you for sharing that again, and actually continuing to be an inspiration to people, even if you don't know you are. You absolutely are. And I'm going to even chip in and give the other fella a bit of credit as well. You're not too bad yourself. The odd time. And speaking of diversity, actually, working this afternoon on the second season of Built Different. So Joella and Benita will be back soon. And I'm, as I say all the time, young people scare me. They talk about things that I have no idea about, but I'm looking forward to working on the second season of that as well. It'll all be available soon. Thanks for listening, folks. I hope you go and check out the documentaries if you haven't already. And I hope we can do something better, because the people who take the stand up for what is right shouldn't be the ones that have to pay the penalty. Talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.